This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best in arts and culture from National Public Radio. I'm Neda Ulubi, arts reporter.
And I'm Felix Contreras, arts producer.
Culturetopia is replacing our old books and movies podcast, so don't be perplexed or perturbed when you're hearing our voices doing this thing.
The thing this week includes a story about a publishing icon who pushed the envelope, and also a conversation with women involved in a play about the gorgeous creations that African-American women wear on their heads to church. And we'll also hear some music about some of the violence associated with the drug trade in Mexico.
We're going to start, though, with a piece about a movie that has a very interesting backstory. A couple of years ago, reporter Wade Goodwin did a piece about a young woman who was falsely accused of dealing drugs. It was part of a whole scam happening in a little town in Texas where, in order to keep getting federal money, these local law enforcement was just scooping up innocent people and charging them with dealing drugs. A movie producer was driving down the street, listened to Wade's story, and decided to do a movie about it. It screened in the little town where it all began, and Wade went back, did a piece about the screening and the story that started it all.
It's a beautiful evening, and inside the auditorium of Hearn St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church, people are buzzing with excitement. It's a Hollywood premiere, East Texas style. There's no red carpet, but there are rumors that the Ku Klux Klan is on its way. The studio has hired armed guards just in case.
It now being 6 minutes after six, and some anxious studio-type people looking to have this evening's presentation begin momentarily.
Father Robert Harold has been ministering in East Texas for most of his life, but he's been a pastor in Hearn just 2 years. By agreeing to rent his auditorium for the movie premiere, the good father is learning a lesson.
I've been criticized as being a dupe of the ACLU, of not understanding the socio-political context of the character of Robertson County and Hearn.
The district attorney depicted so unsympathetically in the film is still the DA here, and when Father Harold handed out posters advertising the movie premiere to local merchants, a few days later he noticed they were missing from the storefront windows. He says somebody from the DA's office, dressed in a SWAT uniform, had dropped by.
They had been visited, and were told it might go better if their poster was removed.
Such is the context for American Violet, a fictionalized retelling of the story of Regina Kelly. Kelly was one of more than two dozen public housing residents, nearly all of them black, who were targeted by the Robert County District Attorney, then arrested and charged with selling cocaine. Kelly says the police raided the public housing project in Hearn on a regular basis.
This is something that's been going on since I was a little girl.
Kelly shakes her head in disbelief that part of her life is now a major motion picture.
I did not do anything. Dee, it ain't always about you. You got kids to take care of.
Mama, these police been raiding this project since I was a kid.
Playing Regina Kelly in the movie is newcomer Nicole Beharie, and she puts down her marker as an actor to watch. In this scene, Beharie's wrongly imprisoned character argues with her mother, played by Alfre Woodard, over whether the young woman should cave in, plead guilty, take the probation offered by the district attorney, and not get involved with the ACLU.
You can't be Beckett.
He wants to put me in prison for 16 years.
Beckett don't care nothing about you. You take the plea, he will leave you alone. You stay to yourself, he ain't gonna bother you never again.
Why should I have to keep it myself? You think it's gonna stop because I plead guilty?
Excuse me, why is that any of your business?
After what they done to me, Mama, they made it my business.
Dee! Dee, wait a
minute! No, Mama!
Even though the story of American Violet is cloaked in the anonymity of the piney woods of East Texas, it quickly becomes clear lives are at stake. Character actor Will Patton gives a strong supporting performance as a local white attorney who's been asked by the ACLU to help.
What do you need local counsel for? Doesn't the ACLU have enough lawyers?
We need insight into the local justice system.
It's simple. The DA decides what he wants, the cops go and get it for him, and the judges bless what they have done.
Are you hostile toward this case for some reason, Mr. Conroy?
You're asking me to sue everybody I ever met for racial discrimination. Now, you know where we are down here? You might as well ask me to stick a shotgun up my ass and blow my head off.
Well, that's very colorful.
The audience for the premiere at St. Mary's was about three-quarters African-American and watched with wonder and enthusiasm as the lives of people they know played out on the screen. James Taylor has lived in Hearn all his life.
Maybe now people can open their eyes and realize what's going on in these smaller towns more than just the bigger cities.
There were some older white couples who, when asked to comment, raised their hands and waved as they walked away. A younger white man, Dale Willard, was one of the few willing to share his reaction.
It's nice that they changed the name and all that, but we all know it was Hearn. And we all know it was in 2000 and what they did was wrong.
You like the movie?
Oh, excellent movie. Good script, good actors, great movie.
Suing local law enforcement for racial discrimination in East Texas is a perilous undertaking. Making a good Hollywood film about it can be just as problematic. But this time, it turned out well. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
So we called Wade at home in Dallas to ask him a question. Why didn't he talk about the fact that it was his story that inspired the entire movie?
Decorum. The writer, the person who wrote this movie, heard a piece I did while he was driving home in Boston, and then the movie came out of that piece. He went down to Hearn. He spent weeks filming in Hearn to get a feel for the place, and he said that while he wrote the piece, he tried to keep, that story in the back of his mind. So certainly the movie is, to extend a movie can be based on a public radio piece. I guess this movie had its origins in that reporting.
So did he call you? Is that how it came about?
No. The thing is, that piece was in 2002, I believe, and he spent 7 years developing this movie, and I found out about it when a PR guy called me to tell me that they were previewing the film in Hearn, and would I be interested in covering something like that? And he said, since the movie's kind of based on your story. And I said, what? And he said, yeah. He said, this movie is based on your story. That was the first I'd heard of it.
And then you called your lawyer.
I checked my pockets, and they were empty.
Were you at all disappointed there wasn't a crusading young reporter played by maybe Brad Pitt in the movie that, did a radio story about what was going on?
Yeah, Brad Pitt. Let me think. Who's the guy who lived abroad for a while? I think he lived in Italy. Played the pirate?
Johnny Depp.
See, I think I'm kind of more of a Johnny Depp. Don't you?
Having never met you, but just listening to your voice, I'll go with Johnny
Some
Depp.
Some guy with long knives coming out of his fingers. That's what I want. Playing me.
You got it. We'll call that director.
Okay, good.
Thanks so much, Wade.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Other people who understand the importance of costume, the people who wrote the popular play Crowns, which is about the hats that African-American women wear in church. Recently, Tell Me More host Michelle Martin interviewed Marva Hicks, who plays one of the characters in the play Crowns.
You learn ways to keep your hat on your head. Don't let people touch the hat. Don't let people knock the hat. And don't let people hug too close. Those are the Hat Queen rules.
Yes. Did you come by your hatitude honestly? Did you grow up wearing hats?
I don't know, Michelle. I did not really. I grew up in a family of women that appreciated hats, that worked for their hats, that hats were an important part of their outfits, particularly for the holidays. And Easter, I always had a hat and gloves. I remember those lovely days.
The production makes the point that hats have such an important kind of historic
yes.
Importance mm-hmm. to African-American women. What is that importance for people who haven't yet seen the production, don't know about it?
That old expression, crowning glory, is very much a part of our culture, and we're not sure. We start the show in Galles, which takes us all the way back to the motherland. And, that's the first hat that I think we experience as part of our culture. But I think it's just something that just completes us somehow. It's a very high calling when you wear a hat. It puts you in a different sort of a status. You feel a little more lifted up when you have that crown on your head. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is. Maybe it's a spiritual thing as well as a cultural thing, but it lifts you up a notch.
Aw.
That was nice.
That was really nice.
One of the most obvious examples we saw recently was Aretha Franklin on the steps of the Capitol when she did that beautiful song, and she was wearing a crown, man. That was a crown.
President Obama, by the way, is a major fan of a major cultural figure.
Who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
This is the 10th anniversary of SpongeBob SquarePants, that popular kids show. NPR's Elizabeth Blair looked into his enduring appeal.
SpongeBob SquarePants is crazy popular. One week last month, 9 of the top 20 spots on cable were SpongeBob. 9 of the top 20. How can that be? My 4-year-old likes it for the gags. Robert Thompson, PhD of Syracuse University, likes the aesthetic.
It's just so trippy. With shows like SpongeBob, who needs drugs?
Hail, oh great Swami of the Gnarly Pounders. We seek audience with thee.
Plus, we want to talk to you.
SpongeBob makes no sense. He lives underwater in a pineapple in a place called Bikini Bottom. At heart, he's an eternal optimist.
Well, we burned our food, ruined our tent, and lost all our water. Patrick, we are going to need to use our razor-sharp quick wits if we're going to make it out of here alive.
Gotcha.
But he's also prone to melodrama. Tom Kenny is the voice of SpongeBob.
SpongeBob is pretty bipolar. I mean, his highs are very high, but he can also be dashed into the most abject sorrow.
That stupid toy!
It's a wild bunch down there in Bikini Bottom. There's an evil plankton, the greedy Mr. Krabs, and Squidward, SpongeBob's cranky neighbor.
All right! What's going on?
It's like the Honeymooners meets the Flintstones on speed. Underwater. SpongeBob's best pal is a lumpy starfish named Patrick. Think Barney Rubble, only dimmer. Their relationship makes the show, says 7-year-old Jamie Sunata.
SpongeBob SquarePants is about friendship.
I'm waiting.
We're waiting. SpongeBob, what are we waiting for?
We're waiting for the mailman. He's bringing me a free toy.
I love toys. Can I wait for your toy with you?
Why, sure.
We're waiting.
SpongeBob is so popular, Nickelodeon squeezes everything they can out of it. Brown Johnson is Nickelodeon's president of animation.
So if we're feeling sort of down in the ratings, we just put it everywhere.
Sometimes it's on 8 times a day. The guy who created SpongeBob is a marine biologist turned animator. When Steven Hillenburg first pitched SpongeBob, Brown Johnson says it was a fight to put it on.
Certain parts of the business at Nickelodeon were like, oh no, it'll never be successful, it's about a sponge, and what's that, and it's yellow, and that's a bad color, and, you know, it's like not eating the yellow M&Ms or something.
And now you can buy SpongeBob underwear and SpongeBob mac and cheese.
I don't think we can possibly overestimate how much this has penetrated American culture.
Syracuse University's Bob Thompson.
You watch it when you're a little kid and you like it because it's pretty and it's funny and they do goofy things. You watch it again when you're 10 and suddenly all of the new mysteries of life begin to sort of pop up in here as well. And then you watch it when you're a 21-year-old in a frat house and suddenly it's got a whole other quality that appeals to you.
45 million people over 18 watch SpongeBob every month, according to Nickelodeon. Tom Kenny says he'll gladly be the voice of SpongeBob for another 10 years.
Even if the show doesn't go for 10 years, I'll be the guy pushing a grocery cart around with the tinfoil hat on his head going, hey, you know who I used to be? Bah! Does that ring a bell? Remember that show? Bah! Give me money. Give me a quarter.
As part of SpongeBob's 10th anniversary celebration, tonight there's a special episode with a guest appearance by Johnny Depp. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
My kids love SpongeBob.
I love Johnny Depp, and he is just a recurring character in the podcast today. I'm very excited about it. There were a lot of nice comments about the SpongeBob piece on our website, including one from a 10th grade biology teacher who wrote, for the past 3 days, we have been practicing genetic crosses using SpongeBob.
You know, what's interesting about some of the television shows, the SpongeBob, and it was brought up in the piece, like there are these different levels. I'm like, I watch these kids, especially SpongeBob, I watch these shows with my kids, and they're laughing. And then a second later, I'll laugh because the writing is such that there are two jokes. It's brilliant and funny, like you said, for everyone.
Brilliant writing was the stock in trade for Barney Rossett. That is a gentleman who was at the center of some of the most important developments in modern American literary history. First to publish Samuel Beckett in this country, and he actually went to court to publish D.H. Lawrence and Henry Miller. Rossett's Grove Press and Evergreen Review were essential vehicles for American writing from the mid-1950s through the 1970s. John Kalish has this profile of a publishing legend.
Rossett knew nothing about the business of publishing, but one of the first books Grove put out in 1954 became one of its most important, Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett.
He had been published in England. I think it gets forgotten. He had written a novel, Murphy, and at least two other books which had been published in England, and they were just lost. Beckett was very bitter about that, so he turned to France because they took him. And I turned to him because he was available. That's a very key thing. Nobody else wanted him in this country.
In fact, it wasn't until Waiting for Godot opened on Broadway, 2 years after Rossett published the play, that sales took off. Over the years, Grove did have a couple of bestsellers, including A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole, and Eric Burns' look at transactional analysis, Games People Play. Grove championed the avant-garde and politically inflammatory. It published the autobiography of Malcolm X after Doubleday dropped it, and Grove published a who's who of 20th century playwrights, including Eugene Ionesco, Harold Pinter, Tom Stoppard, and David Mamet. New York newspaper writer Jerry Tolmer says Grove's output went hand-in-hand with an explosion of activity off-Broadway.
All these damn plays that were coming up like mushrooms out of nowhere, Barney published them all. Every week there'd be a new beautiful paperback edition of some great playwright's newest play.
In 1957, Grove Press got into magazine publishing. The Evergreen Review became one of the most important magazines of the counterculture, says writer and musician Ed Sanders, who was captivated by the poems he read in its pages.
These things you read when you're a kid are like reading Genesis and Exodus for a person who wants to be a minister. You know, I wanted to be a poet, and so reading these were like sacred preparation texts for a whole life.
Hello, I'm Barney Rossett. On today's Evergreen Review, we're presenting a modern poet who talks to you. His name is Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
The poets who so wowed a young Ed Sanders in the magazine could also be heard on the Evergreen Review radio show.
I read the papers every day and hear humanity amiss in the sad plethora of print. I see where Walden Pond has been drained to make an amusement park.
2 years after launching the Evergreen Review, Barney Rossett stepped into the national headlines. American publishers had shunned D.H. Lawrence's novel Lady Chatterley's Lover because of its frank sexuality. Rossett decided that Grove would publish it. After the Postal Service impounded more than 100 copies of the book, Rossett went to court claiming it was protected under the First Amendment. He won. But that was only part of his strategy. His real goal, Rossett says, was to publish another banned book, Henry Miller's 1934 autobiographical novel, Tropic of Cancer.
I thought that for me to do Lady Chatterley's Lover before Tropic of Cancer would be more acceptable because D.H. Lawrence was a famous writer and revered at many levels, and Lady Chatterley would be more feasible to make a battle plan for, and we did exactly that.
Rossett's battle took him all the way to the Supreme Court, where he prevailed. Despite all of his accomplishments and the accolades they've earned, Rossett focuses on the loss of Grove Press and his shortcomings as a businessman when asked to assess his legacy as a publisher.
I think we published a lot of good books. A lot. But I ultimately goofed terribly.
Barney Rossett still publishes the Evergreen Review online. Rossett has finished an autobiography called The Subject is Left-Handed. The title comes from his FBI file. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Now, one of the interesting things about Grove, Felix, is that it was never about making money. When my mom was a teenager, she lived in a in El Paso, Texas, which is right across the border from Mexico. And she could go across the border and buy banned books. And that's what she and her high school friends used to do, is they would go and they would buy D.H. Lawrence and Henry Miller at these bookstores in Juarez, where they were freely available. There's like anarchist literature, all kinds of stuff you couldn't get in the United States in the early 1960s.
Wow. And that border, boy, it's always the free flow of information and unfortunately the free flow of negative things too, which is what we're going to talk about in the next story, a story you did last week about a group of musicians who are reflecting on the violence that comes along with that free flow of drug money and drug violence. A band called the Criollas did an update on the traditional Mexican corrido, which goes back to the Mexican Revolution. And their song is called 12 Heads in a Bag.
My name is Hector Saldaña, and I'm the lead singer for the Criollas.
Mataron a los soldados. Nunca volverán.
The Criollas are a band from San Antonio, Texas, where drug killings in Mexico make headlines. Saldaña was inspired to write the song after reading about a grisly retaliation against the Mexican government's war on drugs. Gangsters dumped a plastic bag filled with human heads near a mall in southern Mexico.
They had no bodies. They had no ID. They could not be identified. Some they figured were soldiers because of the short hair cuts that they had. They had a note on the bag that said, "For every one you take, we'll take 10.
12 heads in a bag left on the side of the road, found in a country God no longer knows."
The song is on the Criollas' new album, Longleaf Pine. Hector Saldaña says he wrote it originally as a folk rock tune, but it came out like a corrido.
You know, corrido is like the blues is in the American idiom. It has a certain sound.
And recurring themes.
Political implications, murder, usually, drugs.
12 Heads in a Bag is a hybrid, mixing Spanish and English, Mexican conjunto music, rock, and traditional folk. Saldaña covers music for the San Antonio Express News. He and his brother founded the Criollas as teenagers in the 1970s. They've scored a few regional hits, making them a known quantity at last month's South by Southwest Music Festival.
Folks, how many of y'all ever heard of the Criollas even, you know?
The Criollas performed at a showcase hosted by Little Steven Van Zandt, best known for his work with Bruce Springsteen and the HBO series The Sopranos. Now he plays the Criollas on his New York-based satellite radio show.
Oh, we love them. You know, we're probably the only ones in the country playing them, and we're playing them in heavy rotation.
Up till now, the Criollas have mostly been known for boppy garage rock. But lead singer Hector Saldaña felt he had to create a response to the staggering number of drug murders, over 6,000 since last year.
I hate to say it, but you almost get numb to it. You read these stories all the time, and the details are there in these news accounts, and it was on my mind, and it actually became a song. And my mother actually saw me writing these words down. I was at her house, and she was saying, "Well, that's so gruesome. Why do you don't write about that?"
But Saldaña says the lyrics just poured out of him.
12 heads in a bag, screaming out, "What did you do? Wrapped up like garbage, be thankful it ain't you. Found a few in Chiapas, down in Juarez too, where the girls lost are faceless and the killers wear no shoes."
Hector Saldaña's family is Mexican, but they've lived in the U.S. for generations. As a kid, Saldaña used to visit relatives in small Mexican towns that he says, back then, were boring. Now they look and feel like war zones. Saldaña hopes someday they'll be boring again. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Good piece, Netta.
Thanks, Felix.
It was, again, an instance of music, culture, and words interpreting today's events going on, which is what the whole podcast is about, really, trying to interpret the world through arts and culture.
That's Culturetopia. Thanks for joining us.
Dejaron los cuerpos descalzados. Nunca sabrán quiénes son.